as soon as it kicked in, the microdose, I found myself in a grave in the middle of a desert, wrapped in two pieces of white cloth. And it was a beautiful sunny day with clear blue skies. And it was the scariest thing I've ever done in my life, with probably the best results.
In the tropical forests of central West Africa, there grows a shrub known as Tabernanth iboga. It doesn't look too remarkable. It grows to be about 6 feet high with clusters of yellow-orange fruits that look like a cross between a sweet potato and a lemon. But the root of the iboga plant contains the powerful psychoactive alkaloid ibogaine. This medicine has been used for generations in the Bwiti spiritual tradition practiced in Gabon. We are only just starting to understand all the ways that ibogaine can be used in a Western medical therapeutic setting, but it is clear that ibogaine has the potential to treat opioid addiction. Today, we're discussing how preservation and improved accessibility to ibogaine can change people's lives. Welcome to Mind Curious, a podcast for those looking to explore the potential of psychedelic compounds. I'm your host, Dr. Sherry Walling. Before we dive in, I just want to add one common sense reminder that this podcast does not constitute medical advice. The perspectives of our guests, Fawad Kelsey, Hamilton Morris, Dr. Dan Engel, are theirs alone, and they don't represent me, my opinions, or those of our host, Mind Cure Health. Let's dive in. We are going to begin our deep dive into the power of ibogaine with a story about how this plant medicine pretty much cured a man's opioid addiction. If you've been following the podcast, you might recall my guest Fawad Kelsey from our episode on religion and psychedelics. Fawad is an imam at the Langley Islamic Center in British Columbia, Canada. Growing up, Fawad was a straight-laced, devout young man with no experience with drugs. But in 2012, his life took a drastic turn on a family vacation.
I took the family to Orlando, and we were literally in the parking lot of Disney World. I think it was the Animal Kingdom. And, I just had this sharp pain right in the middle of my abdomen, just shooting right into my back. And I didn't understand what was going on. And I was so uncomfortable driving there, just got there and everybody's excited. And I just said, I can't even walk. I can't even breathe properly. And I think I'm just going to go back to the hotel and rest it out. And I'll catch up with you guys. It was horrendous. I don't even know, how I dealt with that pain. I ended up staying in the hospital there for 11 days. And, they did every test in the book, and they diagnosed me to have pancreatitis, and they couldn't figure out why. And so that is where my journey began with opioids. They prescribed oxycodone. They said, just take it whenever you need it for the pain. I really can't treat your pancreatitis, except they just, kept me hungry for like about a week, 8 days, and kept me on IV until my pancreas shrunk and, let me go and sent me away with this bottle of pills. And, every time I took them, I would feel back to normal. I'd be pain-free and it would wear off. I would come back. So then after that, I had 7 more pancreatitis attacks in 2013. And then, they changed the diagnosis to chronic pancreatitis, and they just kept on prescribing opioids. And then it went from oxycodone and oxyneo, long lasting, short acting, everything. And I was on them for 5 years, and the last dose I ever took was 55 pills, equivalent to over half a gram of oxy. And I went from being someone that had never used anything in my life to someone who was heavily dependent and addicted to opioids, and I couldn't live without them. Where I actually realized and where I knew I was addicted was 2015, December 25th. So 24th, I ran out of my medicine, or so-called medicine of oxycodone. And, I asked my wife to get me my pills, and she said, you only got a couple left here. You're going to be out. Because she was worried that, the doctors are closed on Christmas. And so she said, your meds are going to be finished. And I said, I'll be fine. It's okay. I'll deal with it for a day. And that was the first time where after like, 8 hours, I started going into full blown, withdrawals. And Christmas of 2015 was the worst possible day of my life. My whole body was on fire. Every single bone in my body was aching. I was throwing up all over the place. I'd lost control of my bowels. I had literally locked myself in a room for 16 hours because I didn't want my children to see me in that condition. My wife was crying and I was begging her to hit me in the head with a bat. I said, just knock me out. I said, I don't know what to do. I'm going crazy. And that was the toughest day of my life. And I went into the doctor's office on the 26th, first thing in the morning. I wanted to kill the guy. And I said, it was the worst day of my life. Just give me the injection or whatever it is to calm me down and get me back to normal, or give me the antidote to this ridiculousness. And he was like, it doesn't work like that. And you should have gone to the hospital. They would have refilled your prescription. And I really had no idea that I was addicted. I just took it as it said. It said take as needed every 4 to 6 hours. And the doctors had told me that it was for pain relief. And when it stopped working, I would just, when I started feeling like, okay, the pain wasn't going away, I'd just go to the doctor and he'd increase the dosage. He's like, yeah, this, you have to increase it every now and then. And then they were increasing it every month. And I really, now that I look back, it's really easy to talk about it. But I never had a clue that I was addicted until that particular day. And so a year before I actually was cured, my doctor was audited. He was told to get me off of the oxys because I was being prescribed like terminally ill cancer patient dosage. And they gave him 3 to 6 months to get me off. And that's where my real struggles started, because I couldn't handle the withdrawals as he was chopping me down. So I turned to the streets and started replenishing my, the stuff that he was cutting down. I had to find somehow to stay normal. The last 8 months of my addiction, I was being chopped down by my doctor, and he was just proud of me because he thought I was just doing wonderful, but he didn't know that I was replenishing it off the streets. And I ended up spending $40,000 in 8 months, $5,000 a month on average. And, luckily I had some angels looking after me. Even the guy that was supplying me was just really careful about getting me the same stuff that I was getting from my doctor. So he was like, listen, I'm not in the business of making addicts. And I say these things because everybody judges these people. But this guy was like, I need to see your prescriptions. I need to see your bottles. Even though he was a dealer, he was like, I'm not going to kill you. I don't want to kill you. I know what they're doing. This war on opioids is killing people and ruining their lives. And so he was really caring. And I remember these people in my life as blessings. And he got me through it when the medical system was my enemy. My doctor was my enemy. And so I got to a breaking point because I started seeing my bank balance just disappear. And I started seeing that I was going to end up on the streets at some point. I just started seeing the end, and I broke down and I told my family and I said, I need help. I've been doing this for the last 6 months and I'm going to go broke soon. And the end is near. And honestly, that was the best thing that could have happened to me for my faith, because that's where I was literally cornered in. And I just turned to God then and I said, listen, if this is life, then I don't want it anymore. You gave it to me, so take it away. And if it isn't, then you got to get me out of this. Like, I have nowhere to go but you. And that's where, like, literally things started changing.
After Fawad reached out to his family and community for help, a friend suggested a change of scenery. Fawad took that advice, and he and his family traveled from British Columbia to the U.S. On that trip, Fawad made a discovery that would ultimately save him.
For the last 10 days of 2016, we ended up going to San Francisco. And on New Year's Eve, that's where the miracle happened. New Year's Eve, we came back from the fireworks back to the hotel and I couldn't sleep. So I turned on the TV and I started watching an episode of Law and Order. There was literally nothing else on TV. And I ended up seeing this episode on Ibogaine and how it helped this heroin addict solve their case. And I don't want to go through the story, but
on Law and Order, this is where you learned about Ibogaine. That's so funny.
For like 6 months prior, I was researching on how to kick the opioid habit, and I couldn't find anything other than the mainstream like rehab and this and that. And I never ever came across Ibogaine or Iboga. And lo and behold, this Law and Order episode. And then I turned to my wife right after and I said, hey, heroine's from the same family. And she's like, why would you believe in what Hollywood's like throwing out there, right? And they're taking on the pharmaceutical industry in that episode and saying that they don't work on cures. And that's why Ibogaine's not available. They work on just maintenance and making sure they have a customer always. It's just, why would you believe what Hollywood's pitching? And I said, you know what? I don't know, but I didn't understand why we were in San Francisco. I was grouchy the whole time. I didn't want to be here. I know now that I was brought here for this reason. And I started researching like a madman. As soon as I typed in Iboga, like a gamut of information came up online. And I started watching videos and people's experiences. And I was going to go to Mexico. And, you know, I ran into a friend and she told me that, why were you going to Mexico? And I said, well, it's not legal here. And she said, who said it's not legal? I said, well, in Law and Order, it was illegal. And she's like, is that the basis of your like research? And I said, well, I would assume that, you know, US and Canada is similar. So if it's illegal in the States, then it should be illegal here too. She's like, no, it's actually unregulated here. And there's a treatment center right in West Vancouver. So that's where I met my angel, Trevor Miller. So I contacted him and he was fascinated by the story. And he said that we treat people that are recreationally abusing, but we want your case because you're someone that has been medically mismanaged and you've not used anything recreationally. So, you know, welcome aboard and we'll see you in March. And that was January. And so he booked me in for March. And that's where my journey with Ibogaine started.
What was that like for you to finally have this sense of there's something that can help? And then I want to hear what the treatment was like for you.
Yeah, I was excited. I was super naive because I underestimated the power of Iboga. I watched a lot of videos and I just thought I was going to take some tree root.
Like drink a tea and...
Yeah, I just thought I was going to take these, you know, capsules and I was going to see green men jump around and they're going to talk to me and they're going to laugh and I'm going to be like funny for a bit. And I'll wake up and I'll be cured. And it was nothing like that. It was life-changing. And you have to remember, like, I never used anything in my life. And so, you know, like, I had no understanding about psychedelics other than, you know, what I'd seen in TV or movies and just, like, some wavy patterns and, like, you know, the 60s and the 70s, lights flashing. And that was psychedelics for me. But I had hope again. Like I knew from New Year's Eve, January 1st, that I had found the solution. Like
you just felt that in your soul. You knew.
Yeah. Because everything, like I told you, like everything happened when I was cornered in and I asked and I was given. Like, and the relationship with God for me changed from like this journey actually changed my relationship with God from a textbook relationship, from belief to conviction. Okay, that's the best way that I can explain it. And so I knew that his plan was in effect.
Talk to me about what the experience was like for you taking the medicine. Did you see little green men that jumped around and you were all better? It sounds like it was different than that.
Oh, yeah. I did see the little green men, though. I'd seen them at one point. And they were fighting the opioids. The experience was amazing, frightening. It was the scariest thing I've ever done in my life with probably the best results. Scary in the sense that I was so sensitive to anything. They started me off at the treatment center using a microdose. So they do that for everyone. There was three of us getting treated at the same time. It's a really professional operation. And so they started me off with a microdose. And the microdose was just supposed to check how my body would react just to make sure that I didn't have any sort of allergies or anything. And I actually went on a full-fledged psychedelic journey on the microdose, which was pretty cool for Trevor and his team to see. But as soon as it kicked in, the microdose, I found myself in a grave in the middle of a desert wrapped in two pieces of white cloth. And it was a beautiful sunny day with clear blue skies. And that was the freakiest thing I've ever seen in my life. That's how my journey started. And I just tried to wiggle myself out of those two cloths. And I was like, oh my God, I'm dead. I died. Like, I was like, this is the stupidest thing I ever did. Let's do this. And now I'm dead. And I was trying to wiggle out of it. And then I just started hearing chants of prayers from Mecca. And I started seeing the house of God in Mecca, the Kaaba, as it's known. And I started seeing people walking around it and chanting prayers. And I just, you know, opened my eyes and started crying and bawling to my wife. And I said, save me, help me, I'm gone. And, you know, literally my heart was shaking and it was so real for me, the experience. And then, you know, I was told to close my eyes again and just relax because, you know, if you get frightened, just open your eyes and you can close them again. And I did so. Then I seen myself running towards this amazing light like I've never seen before. And I had two steel suitcases in my hand. And I was running, running, running. I don't know why I was running. And all of a sudden, the steel suitcases fell out of my hand. And they opened up and they were empty. I literally fell to the ground and I started bawling my eyes again. And I was just crying. And my literally physically, I was in this world, I was shaking as well. I look back and I see myself, like, just that little tidbit about me running towards the light. I felt like I was running towards God. And when the suitcases emptied up, when they fell to the ground and they were empty, I seen my life. And it was empty. And I fell to the ground because I had nothing prepared. Well, I was taking nothing with me to God. And I had nothing prepared. So I felt like I was a failure. And that's why I was bawling, was that I wasted my time in this life and I didn't prepare for my meeting with my Creator. So the journey changed my life. It was the hardest thing I've ever experienced in my life to deal with that. I dealt with things like my past. I dealt with my siblings calling me names when I was kids, or even getting bullied in school, or the things that I had wronged others with, right? Like, I had to deal with all of that. It came all up in that journey. And there was a warrior within me that woke up and, you know, that just dealt with them. And then there was this fictitious sword that came out of nowhere. And I just started ripping these memories and this life experiencing up. And to be honest, after that happened, after I went through that, I've never been burdened again about my life. Like, it was like I was free from those burdens.
And the desire for the OxyContin was gone immediately? Like, in that day, it ended?
So not with the microdose. So I was in the treatment center for 8 days. I was supposed to be there for 10 days. So after the microdose, I wanted to run away from the center. I didn't want to do it again. And it was, God bless Trevor, because he said, listen, man, that is the most amazing experience I've heard of someone on a microdose. Aren't you a little bit curious about who is going to come out on the other side once this is all done? Hmm. He goes, I'm super excited. He goes, aren't you excited? And he goes, if you're supposed to be here tomorrow, leave that up to God. And I ended up caving and I stayed. And so the small dose, and they do that for a couple of days. And then the fourth day, they do the flood dose. And the flood dose is the big dose. And that's a ceremonial dose. So I was under for, I think, 12 or 16 hours. And once I got out of the flood dose, I was no longer an opioid addict. I didn't have any desire.
It was cleared from you.
It was gone. It was gone. So right up to the flood dose, I was pretty much done with opioids, but I still had in me, there was a bit of it that kept on coming back and saying that, hey, I need it. I need it. I'm feeling pain and I need the opioids. But once I did the flood dose, it just sort of knocked it out of me. I woke up, I wasn't even thinking about opioids. I was just thinking about how to get stronger to get out of here. I wanted to be with my daughter, my sons, and I was just itching to get out. And Trevor was like, listen, you need to get stronger and healthier, and you don't want your kids to see you in this weekend state. So let's just stay. Like, you got to stay. And I said, I'm cured. I'm free. And I got to leave. And they held me back till 8 days. And then I just said, see you later. I'm not staying here anymore. And I ran off to my kids and family. And the amazing part is that since March of 2017, I have not touched a single pill or any sort of drugs. And I was cured of my pancreatitis same time. So I got a clean bill of health since I came back. My doctors were shocked. And he literally made me do a urine test after about a month of me being cured to make sure that I wasn't secretly using opioids. And that's how shocked he was, like how I went from so many opioids to zero in a matter of 8 days.
The speed of Fawad's transformation is hard to believe from the perspective of modern medical science. Opioid addiction is notoriously difficult to treat, which is why it is so deadly and has destroyed so many lives. As Fawad mentioned, Ibogaine is illegal in the United States. In countries where it is unregulated, such as Canada, it is not a mainstream option for treating addiction. But luckily, the research on psychedelics like Ibogaine is steadily increasing. We're just beginning to imagine its potential as a therapeutic tool. Dr. Dan Engel is one of the people exploring possible treatments using Ibogaine. He is a neurologist, psychiatrist, and plant medicine expert. His areas of research include concussion recovery, neurocognitive restoration, and traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs. He's also a primary investigator and consultant in MindCure Health. Dan talks about the accessibility of Ibogaine and other ways that it can be used besides treating addiction.
I had a conversation with a friend yesterday who is a physician, and we were talking about some of the patients that she's treating and just the tenacity of addiction and the way that it was really creating destruction in their lives, as it does in many people's lives. And I said, well, have you heard about Ibogaine? Have you heard about the Iboga plant and some of the potential that this holds for helping to alleviate addiction? And she hadn't heard anything about it. So we had a good long conversation, but I'm really happy to talk with you as someone who is really well-versed and well-studied in the world of Iboga and Ibogaine and the potentials that these medicines hold.
It's such an exciting time in this entire field because medicines that have been used for hundreds, if not thousands of years, are now finding their more contemporary position in this really complex medical mainstream for supporting a lot of treatment-resistant psychiatric conditions that the standard of care has been short in being able to fully alleviate. You know, our standard of care, particularly for addiction, treatment response rates are pretty low. Mm-hmm. And for something like Ibogaine, which is the chief alkaloid in Iboga, which is the whole plant, its recovery rates are pretty phenomenal, particularly compared to the standard of care.
Yeah. Where is it in the world of being accessible to people who are struggling with addiction?
Yeah, it's a great question. In the landscape of different regulatory agencies, policies of access and exclusion on one side of the spectrum and the other, Ibogaine has continuously been in Schedule One since the late 60s, early 70s, when kind of everything was lumped into Schedule One at that point. And because we don't really yet have a clear understanding from the federal government about the excellent potential that these medicines have, there's just continuously been this like locked door approach. There are a few agencies in the States, Canada, and South that are studying it. But in the United States alone, it has just consistently been pretty heavily armored in its unpalatable and unfortunate Schedule One designation. When you look at the global landscape, more and more people are appreciating its benefits and opening up their regulatory agencies to put it into an easier classification or an easier scheduling to work with, whether it's on the research side or on the clinical treatment side. The US has just taken such a strong position over the last close to 50 years, and all of that policy is just taking a long time to update. Most of the medicines don't deserve to be in Schedule 1 anyway. Schedule 1 means that the medicine itself is highly addictive and it has no treatment potential. And we know for medicines, particularly like Ibogaine, psilocybin, you know, the list is long. Those are all still, unfortunately, Schedule 1 federally in the United States.
Despite having very limited evidence that they're at all addictive. And in addition, the potential power that they have to be healing and helpful to people.
Right. Especially for addiction. I mean, Ibogaine is an addiction medicine. Psilocybin has excellent data as an addiction medicine. And this is also to be noted that these medicines, when we're talking about their therapeutic benefit, we're talking about them being used in a therapeutic container. So not just people taking these medicines and being good and like quote unquote fixed, especially if they're doing it in a recreational situation or a setting that's not clinical or therapeutic. And there are huge differentials between those two, whether it's a casual setting or a therapeutic setting. And in the right set and setting, these medicines are phenomenal.
So some of the work that you are doing in the research realm is looking at other potential ways that Ibogaine can be helpful to things like TBI, neuroregeneration. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, Ibogaine and Iboga, again, you know, their relationship, kind of like mescaline is to peyote, for people to be able to understand like, oh, mescaline is the chief component in peyote. Ibogaine's the chief component in Iboga. And it's helpful to recognize when we use medicines in this way, there's benefit because with Ibogaine, there's a more specific dose range. It's easier to use it clinically and get an expected outcome. It does have benefit too when we're looking at the broader context and studying the whole plant itself. And we're still in our infancy to really understand fully how to use these medicines in the best way. So being able to use Ibogaine and identify its therapeutic potential and then scale out from there, groundbreaking research that is able to even look at the entire plant and its therapeutic potential. We're still really just scratching the surface. That's why this research is so important. And then to your question, when we look at something like Ibogaine, it is so complex in its receptor profile, how it works neurochemically, physiologically, psychoemotionally. And because it works on 50 plus different receptor profiles, it has a wide variety of potential therapeutic options. You mentioned neuroregeneration. Iboga and Ibogaine are one of the very few chemicals, potentially even the only one in research that showed to be able to reverse the neurodegenerative effects of Parkinson's disease, the dopamine neurons in the substantia nigra, where they dwindle over time or degenerate over time. Iboga and Ibogaine have shown to be able to reverse that. There are very few, again, if any other medicines and neurochemicals that are able to reverse that degree of degeneration. So that's one area of curiosity. Another that we've talked about already is its extensive history and data in the addiction recovery arena. Thousands and thousands of people have benefited from Iboga and Ibogaine. And thousands are dying daily because of addiction and PTSD related to addiction globally. So this is why the field is exciting, and it's also pretty urgent because these are massive psychiatric epidemics that are plaguing thousands of people globally on a daily basis. Trauma is one of those as well. There are organizations that are using Ibogaine as a treatment for a dual diagnosis of PTSD and addiction. When held in a therapeutic container, it's very good, especially for veterans going through their trauma recovery work to support their addiction recovery work. And there are hundreds and hundreds of consistent testimonials of significant benefit are irrefutable. And so that's just one kind of subset if we're looking at addictionology and how consistently trauma is connected to that. So when we have clients who have a really complex presentation of their underlying core wounds and traumas, and we have medicines that can work on multiple different diagnostic subtypes simultaneously, then it gets really exciting. traumatic brain injury is another area of specialization of mine. And Ibogaine has potential benefit there as well because it's super supportive in accelerating people's cognitive recovery. We could describe Ibogaine, especially when it's used as a microdose protocol, as a pretty significant nootropic or cognitive enhancing medicine.
More of the health promotion than the treatment intervention side, like help a substance that helps to keep the brain healthy rather than is intervening to solve a problem.
Yeah, great distinction there. It might be working to alleviate some of the challenge stemming from traumatic brain injury at a physiologic level. We just haven't studied it well enough. For example, ketamine's quite good at resolving traumatic brain injury. We were one of the first centers to be able to use this a couple of years ago and just saw a significant benefit. And it's probably because ketamine is really effective to resolve a lot of the neuroinflammation that happens with traumatic brain injury. Ibogaine might very well do the same thing. So not only working to accelerate the symptom recovery, i.e. because with traumatic brain injury, oftentimes people have post-concussive syndrome. And that's when you get a variety of different cognitive performance deficits because of an injury. So it's hard to think, focus, concentrate, remember, do your daily tasks.
You're irritable. You can damage relationships. There's all kinds of like other life problems that come along with the TBI.
Totally. So we might see something like Ibogaine being very supportive in supporting the symptom recovery while addressing the underlying issue simultaneously.
In addition to treating addiction, Ibogaine can be used to heal neurodegenerative diseases, the damage caused by traumatic brain injuries, PTSD, and more. But unfortunately, the existence of the iboga plant is nearly endangered due to increasing demand and climate change. So it's important that the iboga plant remains available to the indigenous communities of Central West Africa. Now, experts are looking to make synthetic ibogaine as a possible solution. Hamilton Morris is a journalist and scientist with a background in anthropology and chemistry. You may know him as creator of the hit Viceland documentary series, Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia. On the show, Hamilton travels the world and investigates the history, chemistry, and societal impact of psychoactive substances. He's also joined MindCure as a scientific advisor. On a recent episode of the series, Hamilton traveled to Gabon and participated in the iboga ceremony with the practitioners of the Bwiti discipline. Having experienced its ceremonial use, he's an advocate of preserving the iboga plant and manufacturing a synthetic version of ibogaine. I ask Hamilton for his thoughts on ibogaine and what users of synthetic ibogaine might gain or lose by foregoing the quote-unquote natural option. I'm especially curious about ibogaine as a therapeutic tool. Could you say, I mean, I know you've had some experience with this in Gabon. Mm-hmm. And I guess, yeah, could you say a little bit about the potential promise that it holds?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it offers something that many of the classical psychedelics do not, both experientially and pharmacologically. It has this very, very complicated pharmacology, but experientially, it feels very fortifying, almost like what I would imagine an anabolic steroid feels like, where you have this sense of strength, physical strength, mental strength, and a sort of feeling that you can overcome whatever the challenges are that you're facing. When people talk about ibogaine, it's almost always in the context of opioid addiction, which is fine and good because that is, you know, one of the most challenging substance abuse problems to treat. But I think that that's just the tip of the iceberg and that there is a lot of potential in ibogaine and other iboga alkaloids and synthetic derivatives of ibogaine that could be used to treat a variety of different impulse control disorders and addictions, compulsions, things like that.
I know you're an advocate for synthetic ibogaine. Can you say a little bit about the difference between synthetic drugs versus harvested plant medicine?
I think that we have a tendency to think that whatever nature produces has to be optimized for therapeutic properties in humans. But that's, of course, not why it evolved. It's just a beautiful coincidence that it happens to work as well as it does for humans. And so for that reason, I also think that there's often room for improvement and that these things should be valued for all of the amazing potential that they have, but they shouldn't be looked at as the be-all end-all when it's very possible that we can figure out ways to improve the way that they're delivered and figure out optimal ways to dose them and figure out the best way to combine alkaloids if that is done in order to achieve the best therapeutic outcome.
How long is that scientific process, right, to sort of take something like a plant and then try to reverse engineer it in the laboratory?
Well, it really depends. You know, in the case of ibogaine, a lot of the material that is circulating is produced from another plant alkaloid called boecangene. And in that case, it's technically not even a synthesis. It's a degradation reaction where, you know, in synthesis, you're putting two things together. In a degradation, you're stripping something away. So in that case, it's just extracting and isolating this starting material from this other tree and then basically just treating it with a strong base and alcohol and boiling it for a little while, and you're left with ibogaine. There's also other ways to do it using like a total synthesis process, starting from something like 5-methoxytryptamine. Yeah, the synthesis is not so challenging. I mean, it's been done before many times, and that's not the major barrier. I think the real barrier is just figuring out how best to deliver these things and how to create the best therapeutic framework to provide support for the patient and figure out, you know, what types of aftercare are necessary, what types of integration is necessary. You know, I think we still haven't figured out basic things about how best to use these things in our culture. I mean, there are things that they do in Gabon that are clearly very useful in that cultural context, but I don't know how well they would translate to the medical culture of Canada or the United States. Things like burying people alive and sacrificing a chicken over them.
5 days of drumming.
Yeah, 5-day long fasts, ritualistic bathing processes, extremely painful eye drops, all this stuff. It's very clear that it works well in that culture, but we don't have a framework for that sort of experience in the United States. And we have just a general, I would say, cultural distaste for anything that is uncomfortable.
Well, just give me the pill. Just give me the drug. Doesn't that fix it?
Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking about like whether there would have been as much of a problem with oxycodone as there was if it were just a bitter liquid that people had to drink.
Like if it was uncomfortable?
Yeah, just if they had to taste this bitter stuff, if that would have been sufficient to deter abuse. I mean, I think that that's when people wonder like, well, why isn't there as many problems with these things in these like traditional indigenous groups? It's like, well, yeah, for one, they're pretty much never working with extracted compounds. It's usually outside of like an aqueous infusion. It's usually just a whole plant material. And often there's an associated bitterness that creates some suffering or discomfort in the ingestion that makes it much less likely that people will use these things excessively or frivolously.
So I guess I wonder what's lost when we take these compounds into the laboratory and sort of package them in a way that's easily consumable for sort of Western culture. Like,
yeah, I mean, well, certainly the ritual is lost. The music is lost. It worries me far more than any kind of, people always get hung up in the difference between natural and synthetic. That I think is a total just like non-issue basically. And I've seen people try to figure out insanely convoluted ways, like saying like, oh, there'll be like an isotopic difference in the nitrogen. There could be more radiocarbon in a natural product versus a synthetic one. It's like, if you're getting to the point that you're trying to use trace radiocarbon as a explanation for the difference, like you're thinking in the wrong place. There are much more substantial differences, and those are psychological ones, not chemical ones, which people just tend to dismiss entirely. They're more inclined to create some fictional interpretation involving radiocarbon than they are to acknowledge their own biases surrounding the concept of natural and synthetic. And so when you make these things synthetically, I don't think anything is lost at all. But I think there's sometimes a cultural context that changes and that will in turn have an effect on the experience.
You can make Ibogaine legal and package it up in a pill, but the intensity and weight of the experience necessitates great care and attention. You can't just lift Ibogaine from its original cultural context and drop it into Western medicine. This is a challenge, along with protecting the iboga plant and improving accessibility. But overcoming these obstacles is worth it if it means a possible solution to some of our most difficult medical challenges. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, 70,630 people died from drug overdose in 2019. Over 48,000 deaths were attributed to overdosing on synthetic opioids other than methadone in a 12-month period. In 2017, the Department of Health and Human Services declared a public health emergency related to the opioid epidemic. We are long overdue for some kind of intervention that can help turn the tide against this deadly disease and the millions of families it leaves devastated in its wake. I'm deeply grateful to my guests, Fawad Khalsi, Dr. Dan Engel, and Hamilton Morris, for their wisdom, insight, and vulnerability. For more about our guests, to learn about their backgrounds, or follow them on social media, you can visit us at mindcure.com. Click on the podcast tab and all that information will be right there for you. Thanks so much for joining me. If you have a question or there's a topic you'd like to see us tackle, something that you are curious about, reach out via all the normal social media channels. We would love to hear your feedback, your comments, and your questions. Thanks so much for joining me. Stay curious.